Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting restructuring and the distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today, I'm glad to be joined by Eric Weiss of Alston & Berg. He's a partner at the firm's New York office with a broad base of restructuring experience in complex situations. His experience runs the bankruptcy gamut, including several representations of creditor and lender groups across sectors, including manufacturing, AI, real estate, and working in Chapter 15 situations, and much more. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get into the topic of venue today, I want to give the listeners a little bit of a background on you. Can you kind of tell us really quickly how you got into law, bankruptcy law, and how you ended up at Alston & Berg?
Sure. Like a lot of lawyers, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do when I left law school. I started at a law firm in Chicago, got married, and quickly lateraled to Weil, Gotshal & Manges, which was one of the premier debtor side bankruptcy shops at the time. At Weil, Gotshal, I did finance, but that finance involved a lot of restructuring related components, including, for example, the DIP facility in Enron. And I subsequently steered my career in the direction of restructuring. First doing creditor side restructuring or focus on that at a firm, Kramer Levin in New York City, and then taking my career to Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, where I practiced both creditor side and debtor side restructuring. And today I'm at Alston & Berg, continuing the same practice of a variety of debtor and creditor side representations.
It's so interesting to me how Enron just continues to be kind of a career touchstone just across the industry the more I talk to people.
Yes, it was a fascinating case. At the time, it was the largest. It was quickly exceeded by MCI WorldCom, but was one of the largest bankruptcies after Texaco and involved an enormous amount of complexity, including fraud elements, which you don't find in every case.
Absolutely. So as we mentioned a little bit earlier, the topic today is bankruptcy venue. So as a primer, can we talk a little bit about how much consideration is kind of traditionally given to venue, how important advisors see it, how much of the work you see as being diverted into like picking venue, how important it is?
So venue is very important. Bankruptcy is a difficult process for corporate reorganization, and getting a commercial result from a court and getting the right results are important. The way the United States federal system works, the courts are broken into 9 circuits, and each circuit to some extent sets its own precedent, and precedent set in other circuits is really only persuasive authority. So you can have different interpretations of the bankruptcy code in different circuits. And in addition to that, you have different benches with different levels of predictability and comfort for practitioners. And this very rapidly led to focus on certain jurisdictions as being perceived as perhaps more favorable for restructuring purposes, largely because they were more predictable and people felt maybe the benches were more suitable for what they wanted to achieve. So I would say that early on, Delaware had the lead as a preferred venue. That's in the Third Circuit. And New York was also in the lead in the Second Circuit. And they had some differences in the way certain rulings came out, but those were favored circuits. There were certain circuits like the Ninth Circuit, which often were avoided. And then other circuits got a smattering of cases in other jurisdictions and districts. Delaware, I think, took the lead because it was relatively easy to establish venue there because of the prevalent use of Delaware corporate forms, which meant you had a connection to the venue. But venue rules were fairly liberal and allowed different opportunities to file cases in different forums and venues. So it led to a certain amount of forum shopping, which also contributed to concentrating cases filed in certain jurisdictions.
Right. Like we see a tremendous amount of filing in Delaware and New York still from our end here at DebtWire. And in a bit of a recent example, you know, like it's well known that companies who might expect to want non-consensual third-party releases would pursue venue in New York, like in Purdue. Not so much anymore. We talked a little bit about debtor flexibility in that previous question, but kind of in the recent history, how much flexibility do debtors see themselves as having to kind of pick their venue? Is it a thing that they feel like they really have to work for or plot significantly, or do they really have a good idea of how to get the court that they want?
when you have a particular case and you're the debtor's counsel, right? So you're deciding on venue because ultimately the debtor makes that choice, though it may be influenced by major creditors who are financing the case, right? You can't file someplace. You can, but it's not probably your best move if you're a senior lender who's providing you with post-petition financing isn't in agreement with that. But in any event, so you're presented with a case and then you analyze what are going to be some of the demands of the case. Are you going to need third-party releases? Is that going to be an important feature of your case? Are you going to need a channeling injunction? And based on that, you come up with what would be the circuits where the case law is probably most favorable for things that you want to achieve in the case. Then you have to take a look at what context you have with that jurisdiction. For example, if you are looking at the Seventh Circuit and you have no contacts, you don't have an Illinois corporation, you have no contacts, you don't have bank accounts in Illinois, you don't have other assets in the Seventh Circuit, maybe you think, well, that's a favorable jurisdiction, but I can't really establish venue there and I don't want to initiate my case with a venue failure and a venue transfer. And so there you look somewhere else that might be more likely where you can establish venue. Venue, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't have to be a wrought iron link. For example, I once participated in a case, filed a case of a Panamanian corporation whose asset was a piece of real estate, a hotel in Panama City, Panama, that had a limited connection to the United States, except that it had its cash management system was swept from its bonds into bank accounts in New York. And that was enough to establish jurisdiction and appropriate venue in New York. Previously, it had been the case that people would seek to, for example, have their retainers maintained in a bank account in a jurisdiction that they preferred and tried to bootstrap into that jurisdiction. I think that's fallen out of favor and you have to have a more real connection than that. But those are the kinds of connections that are important. And that's the kind of analysis you do. What do I need? What jurisdictions offer that? What venues offer that? And do I have a sufficient connection for that to be the right choice?
Right. Another kind of follow-up question is, to what degree do things like preference of local counsel play? Do you pursue a certain jurisdiction maybe because you have a local counsel that you like to work with there? Or is it a chicken and egg thing where you build up the preference with that local because you, for other reasons, get into that venue regularly?
So I'd say it's a little bit of both. You wouldn't necessarily choose a jurisdiction because of local counsel, but it certainly can influence the decision. For example, jurisdictions like Delaware, where local counsel sees a large number of cases and can provide not just representation, right, and pro hoc vice filings, but also provide substantive advice and a pool of experience to tap, can be a very valuable tool in a restructuring. So it does influence choice. I don't think it's decisive. You would never choose a venue because of local counsel where the law in that jurisdiction or venue was not appropriate for your case or the bench you didn't feel you were comfortable with, but it definitely is a factor.
So getting kind of into the current landscape a little bit more, in your view, do you feel like it's gotten easier or more difficult or just kind of different year by year when it comes to the ease of filing where a debtor has a preference? Or is it more or less common for companies to worry that much about venue? That's kind of been set aside because we've talked about the importance a lot.
I think the answer to that question is that it's gotten harder, but it's still easy. At one point, as I mentioned before, people were opening a bank account in a jurisdiction in order to establish a connection, and that was sufficient. That's no longer the case, but you don't need an enormous amount of contact with the jurisdiction. If you have an Illinois corporation, you could file in the Seventh Circuit, file that enterprise first, then follow the others. The same is true in Delaware. If you had one Delaware entity, you would be able to file that Delaware entity and all the other entities would file. If you have cash, a significant amount of cash management in New York, you can file in New York. It's not a difficult hurdle, but it has gotten harder than it was before.
And I know that it varies tremendously from spot to spot. Like we just saw in the Sorrento Therapeutics case, they got venue because of, I believe it's a PO box established a week or so before the case filed. It's a California corporation. But Can we just throw out a few kind of examples towards kind of the easier end of things? Like, what are some of the very common bare minimums for establishing a venue if you have to establish it?
The bare minimum would be you have material cash in a bank that's located in that jurisdiction. So if you have a bank account at Silicon Valley Bank, the Ninth Circuit may be the right venue. If you're bootstrapping and opening it to establish venue, it might not be sufficient. A PO box or an address in the jurisdiction, property located in the jurisdiction, be sufficient. Doesn't have to be a ton of property. Incorporation in the jurisdiction. So many corporate structures will have a number of subsidiaries. In order to access a jurisdiction, if you have, for example, a New Jersey corporation in your corporate structure, maybe it's not the most important corporation in your corporate structure, but you could file that first in New Jersey and then file other debtors in the case subsequently and establish New Jersey as your venue. Those are the sorts of things. I would say location of property, addresses, bank accounts, which is a location of property, just another form, and corporate formation.
Now, as you think about kind of the changing, let's call it landscape of venues, of venue selection, venue preference, are there any jurisdictions that you see as on the way up, as in like you would anticipate a growth in their popularity, or the other way, ones that you might anticipate seeing fewer filings in because of some recent development in their case law?
Yeah, very much so. The Fifth Circuit had become quite popular in Texas and is now a little bit eclipsed by events in that jurisdiction related to the bench and certain local counsel firms that have kind of clouded it as a jurisdiction. Judge Jones and Judge Isger in the jurisdictions, very popular, very commercial judges, gave clear direction to their cases, had a clear idea of what they were doing. And I think that drove a lot of filing in Texas. I think other things that influence those types of venue and their popularity is the debtors' counsel. So debtors' counsel tends to be somewhat oligopolistic, meaning there are a handful of firms that are on a short list of firms that you would select for a debtor case, and then there's sort of all the rest. And those firms think a lot about what jurisdictions they think would be best for their clients, and that influences a lot the choice of venue. And if a venue selected for corporate restructuring a number of times, their case law tends to grow, and examples of what that bench produces grows, which makes that venue more attractive. Because where there's precedent, there's predictability. And where there's not precedent, you don't know exactly what you might get. So those are features that influence it. And there's also competition. Each jurisdiction supports a bar of local counsel in their jurisdiction. And it's an important local industry in some sense. And so the bench probably thinks somewhat about, well, what are we doing to be attractive to cases? We can take certain positions and get no cases, which means we can be as right as rain about what the law should be there in terms of within the reasonable interpretation of the law, but we're not affecting anything if nobody files there and it's not applied. So there is competition, and benches are conscious of it to make their venues suitable for filing.
Like one example of a pretty significant change that we might see would be in Eastern Virginia, where we just saw a lead counsel have their application denied because they had some concurrent representations of a shareholder alongside the debtor. They insisted that the representations weren't actually connected. They just had the client at the same time. But that seems like a really common entanglement for a firm. So that could affect how that venue is viewed.
Right. That's exactly right. That's an important case. And the growth of the debtor practice in part was connected to the strength of private equity practices. So private equity practices, right, drive representations of portfolio companies of private equity sponsors. And so when those sponsor portfolios, when portions of it hit a spot of distress, there's a need for a bankruptcy representation of a debtor. And if the firm that has represented the sponsor in connection with those transactions represents the portfolio company, then they may have an opportunity to represent them in a Chapter 11 case, which can be a valuable engagement for the firm. So a kind of case that says that if you represent the private equity sponsor, you can't represent the debtor is problematic for some fairly important structural elements of the way the bankruptcy bar has functioned. Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of goes to show us how this question of venue kind of sprays out into how the whole practice works and how the whole world works, because that affects not just companies in that venue or that venue's popularity, but that's going to affect how law firms approach representations and the kind of the relatively common, you know, sponsor and also board seat holder having kind of like a advisory tie to a debtor.
Yes, that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd add to that, there's become sort of an cross-border element to competition for venue. Mm-hmm. Going back to the beginning, one of the features of the United States Constitution was it created for the federal government bankruptcy power and the power to make uniform bankruptcy laws. Not to delve too much into the past, but this was an important feature because one of the failures of the Articles of Confederation was that there was no national policy on debtor-creditor law, and there were a lot of debtor-creditor fights, which led to this being an important feature of the Constitution. Fast forward many, many years, there wasn't really a bankruptcy law. There was one in connection with the railroad bankruptcies. And then finally, in 1978, the United States passed a fairly liberal law, the 1978 Bankruptcy Code, which included Chapter 11, which was directed at reorganization. And much of the world hadn't really seen this. The idea that a bankrupt should reorganize and continue rather than be liquidated or be at the mercy of its senior creditors was something of a new concept. It was demonstrated to be successful, rescuing companies like Texaco, Enron, which we spoke about earlier, WorldCom, and other big names. And it also proved to be lucrative. And foreign jurisdictions noticed that foreign enterprises that were located in their jurisdictions were filing in the United States. Parmalat is a great example. In at one point, my firm represented Almatis, which was a German bauxite concern. You know, these are, but because you could establish venue in the United States and Chapter 11 was favorable for preserving jobs and getting the right outcomes, people took note. So the world sort of changed some of its laws to be more like Chapter 11. We now have the concept of a UK scheme. There's the Canadian CCAA. There's a new German law, a new Dutch law. There's a French safeguard. And all of these represent, in some form or another, competitions for Chapter 11 in the United States. So you're talking about venue selection across the Atlantic. And a feature that's starting to come to the fore is what might be a toggle plan. For example, you're working on a pre-petition restructuring to be done out of court, and you come up with a number of papers as to what you would like that restructuring to look like on a consensual basis, with the idea that you'll get it done in a case of some kind, some insolvency proceeding, if you can't get it done out of court. You could take a look at the rules of Chapter 11 and what you need to confirm a plan, and the rules, for example, of a UK scheme, and decide, well, I don't really know which one is best. And it really depends on some features of how my creditors organize. And if I can't get it done in Chapter 11, maybe I should do a UK scheme. We saw that in a filing Syncreon, where in order to establish a venue in the UK, lenders agreed to change the governing law of the credit documents in order to create a connection with the UK, and then proceeded to enter into a UK scheme in order to affect their restructuring. Very fascinating development. I think we will see more of that in the future. I think there are some untested legal regimes, particularly the German and the Dutch one, that's most recently developed. And we can expect that there will be not just competition amongst the nine circuits, but global competition for restructuring cases as the world has adopted a reorganization versus liquidation outlook.
And potentially even some domestic competition for Chapter 15, right?
Absolutely. One way of skinning the cat of a global restructuring is you file under, for example, a foreign law like the French safeguard, and you file a Chapter 15 in the United States in order to recognize the proceedings and implement them in the United States. There are various complications to that, and there are probably too many details to go into as to what might be going on in a French safeguard and why that might be the right venue and why a Chapter 15 would be the best way to implement it in the United States. But those are definitely options. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can even do something like that and have a parallel Chapter 11 for certain Chapter 11 filers in order to affect kind of a global cross-border restructuring.
In some ways, it just feels like bankruptcy is kind of a reflection of the way the world works. You know, like as everything else globalizes, so does reorganization.
I agree. It does globalize. And there's a certain universality to reorganization, which is an academic observation. But, you know, one of the first laws that Moses brings out of the desert is a jubilee year, which is every 7 years a relief of debts. Mm-hmm. It vaguely reflects that there's this important issue of tension in debtor and creditor relationships that need to get resolved. And maybe a simple idea of every 7 years purging the ledgers of debt, but there are also other forms. Romans had insolvency laws, which involved mostly debtor imprisonment, but they had other laws which allowed a debtor to get some relief after they liquidated all their property in order to solve the problem of people need a fresh start. When they get in too deep with debt, they kind of stop functioning. That's true of people, and it's definitely true of corporations, but those corporations and what they do and their businesses may be very important to other people who are employed there, to other people who are dependent on the revenue streams, and it may just be the correction of a problem. So the point being, reorganization is sort of a universal thing. It has a long history, which is intertwined with commerce, and it continues to grow. And as the economy becomes global, exactly right, restructuring also, you can expect to become global and to stay global.
I think that's just about an absolutely perfect kind of bookend statement. We got a little bit biblical with it, which I think neither of us saw happening. But Eric, it's been a real pleasure talking today. I appreciate you taking the time to come on and share your thoughts and your expertise with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Andy.
And thank you, as always, to our listeners for checking out this episode of Legal Lens. We'll see you next time.